Welcome to the Blue Jays Plus podcast from Prince George, British Columbia. I am Ewan Ross, and no Gideon this week, so I am joined by...
Chris Sherwin from Windsor, Ontario.
This week on the show, we will be breaking down the rather upsetting Blue Jays draft. That might be overselling it, but whatever, I'm a downer. Ricky Romero and his return to his old mechanics. Some positive news with Mark Burley. An injury update on Jose Reyes and Brett Laurie. Dustin McGowan and him actually getting back to the Major League mound. Roster moves, not as many as last week, but still quite a few. Then an interview with Baseball Prospectus' Jason Wojciechowski on the Biogenesis scandal and specifically Melky Cabrera's involvement in it. Our minor league player of the week, Marcus Stroman. And then a pop culture moment, which is a bit of a departure for us, but I love TV and I'm obsessed with a new show, so we're going to talk about it. Then we'll finish up by looking ahead to the week coming up. So on Thursday, the Major League Baseball draft took place, and with the number 10 pick, the Jays took California high school right-hander Phil Bickford. Chris has been taking a look at his mechanics, so why don't you break him down for us, Chris?
All right, well, we know he throws a big heater. You know, reach up to 98, but sits at around 92 to 94. I don't like his mechanics, but there are some things to like about it. Repeatability is the main one. For a 17-year-old kid, it's very, very simple, very compact, great momentum coming towards home plate, which obviously helps with the 98-mile-an-hour fastball. I can only imagine being 17 years old and being able to throw that fast. It's crazy. I did notice in a lot of the film that I watched, his arm gets really lazy, and he starts to just, you know, release points start to get all off. And again, he's 17, so, I mean, this is to be expected. Obviously, when he gets older and better coaching and whatnot, you know, the stamina will build up.
That is coaching.
Well, yeah, obviously a big concern in this organization. But he does have what's called, depending on who you talk to, is an inverted L. So he will... he's a right-handed pitcher. So when his arm goes back, his palm will be facing first base. And if you freeze frame it, he will be in like an L shape with his arm, with his elbow. And what this does is, as his front shoulder is rotating, and his front foot plants, it puts ridiculous torque and all kinds of just stress on the actual pitching elbow and the shoulder, depending on how high it gets. So obviously the first thing you're obviously concerned about is going to be Tommy John or any kind of other surgery. And at 17, throwing 98 miles an hour with ridiculous amounts of pressure put on that elbow and shoulder, you know, it's the clock is ticking. It's like, okay, is he going to get to AAA before his first Tommy John surgery? And, you know, we can only hope, but, you know, it's not a good sign, obviously. And the other, I mean, the biggest problem, if you want to look at it, if you want to just forget about injuries and blow them off like they're not predictable, that's fine if you're one of those people. But how about the complete lack of breaking ball?
That was my next point.
Yeah, I mean, like he's all fastball, and that's about it. Just a hope that he can reach his high ceiling. You know, Noah Syndergaard. I saw a lot of comps to Noah Syndergaard, hoping that they could be him. And I don't know. At this point, if this is how they're going to draft, I guess I'm okay with it. If at the end of the line, they're not going to try to get these guys to the show, and they're just going to draft all these guys and then trade them. If they're making good trades by using these draft picks, by all means. But I'm not all that confident if they're going to draft this way. I'm not confident that these guys are going to make it to the bigs.
I mean, I completely agree with you. I mean, we did hear a lot of similar complaints about Chris Sale's mechanics coming out, and he's held up just fine. But, you know, the Jays don't have a good history of this. But my issue with this is... not necessarily that they took a pitcher who has flaws, but they appear to be overpaying in order to get him. He had a very high demands for a signing bonus.
Yeah.
So what this has led to them doing is having to skimp on their next two picks.
Exactly. Yeah.
So not only do they have a pitcher who, I mean, when I hear a guy throwing 98 with questionable secondary stuff, to me that screams closer.
Yeah.
Long term, which obviously is not what you want out of your number 10 overall pick.
No.
But looking at the next couple guys that we took, they have Clinton Holland, I think that's how you pronounce it, but whatever, was their second round pick. And first of all, he was had injury issues this year with forearm tightness. This time last year, he was talked about as a first-round pick. But coming into this draft, he was ranked 86 by Jonathan Mayo, 95 by Baseball America, and 73 by Keith Law. And the Jays took him in the top 50. So that shows that they're probably skimping on the bonus in order to get him in to give more money to Bickford.
Yeah.
You said you'd taken a look at Holland's mechanics as well.
Yeah, he's got similar arm issues. Not only that, but his mechanics are just a mess, which is leading to all kinds of command issues. His plant foot lands, I don't know how to describe it, but almost everywhere. Sometimes it's open, sometimes it's closed, sometimes it's to the first base side, sometimes it's the third base side. I mean, these are kids. I mean, this is kind of be expected, but it's a lot of work. And, you know, again, we poke fun at the organization, but, you know, we do it for a reason. When you don't have a good track record for building up talent, you know, I'm going to worry about that stuff. So, and again, it just screams skimped pick. To sign Bickford and his apparently outlandish demands. I don't know the exact number that he's asking for, but, yeah, I mean, you just hear nothing about it being incredibly high, and that's why nobody wanted to sign him.
The one theory there is that he might have been scaring people off knowing that he already had a deal with the Blue Jays. But
yeah.
Keith Law said that, you know, he didn't even want to pass it along because he was afraid that it wasn't true because it was so outlandish. But
I was hearing $3 million, but I don't know how accurate that is. I mean, it's all just, you know, Twitter rumors and stuff. So
yeah, and then I saw a quote saying that the Jays were going to take him, and if they couldn't get him done, you know, he'd take what they were giving him, or he'd go to school, which can't happen after the Tyler Beede situation.
No,
he can't afford to lose picks, even to push him back a year,
especially when they're not stockpiling anymore. With the new CBA and whatnot.
Not possible. And they're not able to go into Latin America and do what they've been doing recently.
Yeah.
But so the second round pick was Clinton Holland, who everyone's got rated low. He was rated higher coming into the draft, but, you know, there's injury issues and more question marks. Their third round pick, Patrick Murphy, an Arizona high school right-hander, their third straight high school right-hander, and there's more to come. Didn't pitch at all this year, and in a phrase that all Jays fans know about, it's because he had Tommy John surgery.
Yep.
Which is great. I mean, that's what we want, guys who have already had Tommy John surgery.
Well, they probably think that, oh, hey, the bad luck's out of the way.
Which we saw with Kyle Drabek is always true. You can
and
never
Frazier.
Have it again.
Frazier had two as well.
That's right. I mean, I've read a bunch of good stuff about Patrick Murphy, but I didn't even see him on Baseball America's top 500 list. Presumably,
I couldn't find him on there either.
Yeah, I think that's because Baseball America had him off the board, assuming he was going to go to school.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I mean, if they think they can buy a kid out of a commitment, you know, whatever, I'm fine with that. But I'm even fine taking a guy who's had Tommy John if you think that it's good enough value. But it's a third-round pick.
Yeah.
So, and again, it's a high school pitcher. They're always risky to begin with. And then their fourth-round pick is a left-hander named Evan Smith, an Alabama high school pitcher, who had shoulder stiffness mid-season and was shut down for about a month.
Yeah.
So there's your first four picks. They're all seemingly boom or bust high school pitchers. None of these guys will be moving quickly. It's just the same old. I'm really tired of it.
Yeah, and they don't seem to have any issue with it. This is, they are very confident with this strategy, and they're very open about it, about not changing. If you read any of the comments like prior to the draft, this is what they're going to do. This is who they're going after. And I kind of made a smart-ass comment on Twitter, because all the comments about Bickford, like, literally nothing about pitching anything. It was all just, you know, well, he's tall and athletic, which is important for a pitcher. But I had to, you know, I had to use the one of my favorite lines from Moneyball, and are we selling jeans?
Are we selling jeans, exactly.
You know, and although that is something that obviously important, you're not going to want to go out and draft, you know, 5'10", 5'11", pitchers. You want to have the pitcher body. But if you're giving post-draft comments and that's all you can come up with, to me that's concerning. If all you can come up with is, oh, he's tall and athletic, he's everything we were looking for. But that's all you can comment on, is that he's tall and athletic, and that's all you're looking for?
Well, and the other thing, like, so the next point that I have is the guys that they passed on at 10. And if they're looking for tall, athletic pitchers, Braden Shipley was on the board. Braden Shipley, in the preview I did and in every mock draft I'd seen, had him going to the Marlins at number 6. But when Colin Moran fell to them at 6, they passed on him. He was a college shortstop up until last year, so he's obviously a really athletic kid. And while he has some questions about his secondary stuff as well, he's a college guy, he's going to move quicker, and he's 6'3". So there's your tall, athletic pitcher.
Yeah.
With a considerable upside as well. So I can't even recall where he went. I think he went, whatever, he went a few picks later. The other guy would be J.P. Crawford, who I wasn't crazy about coming into the draft, mostly because he seemed to be rated that highly based on being the only shortstop available. But Jason Parks, from Baseball Prospectus, was incredibly high on him. I think he had him in the top 5. So that's another guy to keep an eye on. And the final one is Reese McGuire, who, frankly, really surprised me that they didn't take. He's a high school catcher, which is always big risk. But everyone had the Pirates taking him. And then they were saying that if the Pirates didn't take him, the Blue Jays were going to. And if the Blue Jays didn't take him, the Mariners were going to, because he's a Washington guy. And the Pirates passed on him. Jays didn't take him. Mariners didn't take him. And the Pirates wound up getting him at 14. Which is, frankly, a really good move for the Pirates.
I agree. I was high on McGuire. I really did. I liked everything that I saw out of him. And Crawford, I kind of felt the same way that you did with Crawford. It kind of like lack of depth at the position kind of, you know, like sparked the interest in him. Not to say that he was just a terrible prospect.
Push
or whatnot,
him off the board, at least.
Yeah, push him off the board, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, McGuire, for this team especially, who basically hasn't had a catcher since Ernie Witt, and I'm a big honk for college, for catcher defense, and his is apparently the best of any high school catcher they've seen in years.
It was really impressive watching his video.
It was awesome.
If you're a fan of catcher defense, punch in Reese McGuire and watch some of his game film, just even doing just drills, because it's fun to watch.
Yeah, I'll probably include some of those in the description for the podcast in the links, because they're fun to watch even if he isn't a Blue Jay. So that's the draft. You know, whatever. I want the three guys. The reason why I can't be so critical of them is the three guys I wanted. I wanted Austin Meadows, I wanted Clint Frazier, and I wanted Trey Ball. And they were all off the board. If they had taken Bickford over those three guys, I would be raising hell. But as it is,
I wanted nothing to do with Trey Ball, to be honest with you. He's a labrum tear just waiting to happen. It's just awful. It just hurts watching him pitch. That's why I said, let the assholes have him. And then just watch his shoulder explode, hopefully before he gets to the bigs. That's what you can always hope for other teams, is that they can't get a few years out of them before the arm goes.
You're a terrible person, Chris. Okay, on to another thing that Chris is probably going to be a terrible person about. Ricky Romero. More mechanics talk, so why don't you walk us through this?
Okay, well, he's finally admitted what we all kind of knew, and is that he could not wrap his head around new mechanics, just mentally screwed up. So he's ditched them. I don't know if it was his final decision. I don't know how the process went. But
I think it was. I saw comments from the AAA team saying we got to let him do what he wants to do at this point, which I agree.
Yeah. I agree with too. I am all for trying to make healthier mechanics and mechanical changes, but at some point you have to accept the fact that these guys are a certain age and doing things a certain way, and you just kind of hope for the best. And it was not happening. So he's ditching the new mechanical changes, and he's going back to what he did before. And his first start, it seemed to work out pretty well. I mean, I believe he gave up a few runs. I haven't looked at his box score, but
I got it in front of me right here. Basically, he was through five innings with a shutout going, three strikeouts, no walks, and then blew up in the sixth, gave up three runs on a bunch of hits and a couple walks. So
classic Romero, kind of. You know.
Yeah, but frankly, I'm fine with him being classic Romero
too.
Back in the day.
Yep.
So get back to that, please.
Yeah, I'm fine with that as well. Like, you know, he depends on a defense, obviously, and I'm okay with that. I really am. Just go back to, because you know, in this rotation, he was going to be the fifth starter anyways.
Yep.
So you know, that's all we need out of him. So I am okay with that. Get the confidence back. Get out of your head. Just go back and just throw the way you were before. And as long as that elbow is okay from last year, because he did have the little minor surgery on it.
Oh, I hope if there's anything physical wrong with him and they're not taking care of it, what is the team doing?
Yeah, and you know, and he said that he hid that last year. But if there was a growth, as he described it, that got worse as the season went on, who is out there in the bullpen not noticing a growth on your, you know, quote, ace's arm? You know, like, how does nobody notice that as the year goes on last year? Because that really bothers me. How does even a trainer not notice that?
I can't.
He made that comment over Twitter about how the lump got worse and worse as the year went on. It's like, who is not noticing this in the clubhouse?
Especially when the results aren't there. I mean, if he's pitching great and there's a lump, you know, maybe you don't inspect his arm, but when
that second half of 2012, I mean, that was a nightmare. Quicksand, as he described it, felt like he was in quicksand. It's like, how are you not giving a full-on medical look checkup for him? Like, after each start, I don't get it. But, yes, hopefully, ditching everything, getting his head back in check, goes back to old Romero and gets called back up here so we can stop seeing, 2012-style roster moves to fill up the rotation, because it's getting painful.
Yep. One guy who has been decidedly less painful than he was early on is Mark Burley, and you noticed some stuff with him.
I did, yes. In the beginning of the season, or that first month, he was actually typical Burley, but just giving up way too many home runs as opposed to giving up too many home runs. some of the blame can go on JP for some questionable game calling, which I usually praise him for, but with Burley's style, he wasn't calling a very good game, and we all know that Burley doesn't shake off his catcher, so he just smiles and nods and throws. And that was one of the reasons why Gibby started Blanco that one game in Tampa Bay, I believe it was, because obviously he noticed what we noticed, and that was the game calling. But that was only part of it. I went back and looked at his mechanics combined with some of his release points, and there's a few pitches, one being his cutter. Now, usually pitchers are usually much better when their release points are all incredibly similar. But for him, he has different release points and different arm slots for different pitches, and that's how he keeps the ball down. And he, in the first month of the season, it was up, up, up. And he wasn't hitting his spots in the outside part of the plate and whatnot. And I noticed that has cleaned up a lot. His cutter and everything, his release points were all grouped together in a tight spot, which is usually when you see that with any other pitcher, you're like, oh, that's perfect. That's great. But not Burley. Burley's release points are kind of all over the place, and that's how he succeeds. That's how he throws his pitches. So fine. That's, whatever. That's cool. Was not happening in April, and now it looks like a mess again, and that's good for him, which is just so weird. But you know, explain Mark Burley, right? Like, I mean, how has this guy been so successful over the years? But I'm totally happy with that. You know, his pitches are down. His command is down. He is pitching like Mark Burley again, and the last, what, four starts have clearly shown that. So,
yeah, and I think the rotation's looking much better than it was, you know, even a couple weeks ago. Dickey seems to be coming around. Burley's back to his old self, not an ace or anything, but a dependable starter.
Yeah, still a pretty solid pitcher. Yeah.
Yeah, if Johnson's back, he didn't look great today, but got through five.
He didn't look that bad either. I mean, some of the hits, you know, were kind of, you know, bad luck hits that he's been hit with all. It was mostly just the walks today that really killed him, I noticed.
Yeah, absolutely. So, on to some injury news, both positive and negative. I will deal with the negative first because I want to leave on a high point because, yeah, I don't like being negative. Despite what this sounds like. Brett Laurie's ankle injury is worse than it was initially believed. He's been put into a walking boot, and at this point there is no timetable for his return. So that's not good, especially because we saw Andy LaRoche play third base today. And Andy LaRoche is maybe, other than Brandon Wood, the biggest prospect bust of the past 10 years. And I don't want to see him anymore.
No.
But so, you know, maybe a month without Laurie, that's probably a little over dramatic, but
it really hasn't shown any improvement. Swelling, pain. And you know, you have to wonder, is it because he stayed in the game?
Which is crazy.
Yeah. Because like even like when he stood up and was bouncing around and kicking and stuff like that, and it wasn't until he ran, I'm just like, that's why I was actually confident and actually believed Anthopoulos for once, because I'm like, well, it can't be that serious if he stayed in the game after such a horrific slide that it was.
I can't believe for the Reyes injury that they took any chances. It was the exact same injury to a certain degree.
Yeah. I can't believe they let him stay in, and just something as simple as that run to third base could have damaged it even more. And I mean, you know, you look at his oblique injury this year, it actually took him, it wasn't as serious as last year's, and he was actually on the shelf longer. So he's obviously having a problem with healing.
Well, I also think that's a factor with his personality because, you know, if you leave a normal player on second base, let's say Melky Cabrera with his hamstrings after injuring something, he's not going to go all out going to third base.
No.
But Laurie has no off switch, which is what makes him such a fun player to watch, but...
Also concerning.
Exactly.
And it was also the day before, you know, he had something to prove because of the little temper tantrum there, which was literally just the day before. So he had to go out and prove to his teammates and et cetera, you know, all that stuff. And he was having a nice little game. And then that happens. He's pissed. I mean, we all saw the look on his face as he was walking off third base. Totally fine. And running down the stairs like nothing was wrong. This is why I thought it wasn't going to be a big deal.
The adrenaline.
Because it was just like afterwards, it's just like, yeah, you're probably just filled with Red Bull adrenaline.
Four of them, apparently, per game. I laughed at Kevin Gausman's donut regimen before innings, but the Red Bull before the game can't be good for you. The recommended dose is two, Brett. Come on, stick to it.
Four. That's nutty.
I'm still advocating that the Blue Jays should be talking to him about a long-term contract, even with the injury issues. His value is never going to be lower. They need to lock him up.
Yeah, I'm still confident in him as a player. I am.
And the fact of the matter is, his game does not have to get much better for him to be worth whatever contract they give him because his defense is that good at third base.
Well, so, just a little more consistency at the plate, that's it.
Yeah, it's not a case of you needing a young player to develop like an Eric Hosmer in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. He can basically be the same guy he is right now, and he would be worth any reasonable contract they would give him.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So, onto the positive news. Jose Reyes was taking ground balls today before the game. He's been taking batting practice for 2 weeks now since they were in San Francisco. And he is likely to head out on a rehab stint within the next 10 days. This is great news for the Jays because as good as Kawasaki's been for us, you know, he's still Munenori Kawasaki. And yes. Reyes was the spark plug with this team. He was really the only player playing well in April. And getting him back would be massive.
I still can't believe we only got 10 games out of him.
Yes.
10 games. It's just unbelievable. But yes, that is absolutely huge for the club and the fans as well. Because what a treat watching the, you know, depending on what ranking system you go by, the second or third best shortstop in the league for the past, you know, 5 years.
Yep.
Just amazing. Still can't believe he's a Blue Jay for the next 5 years. It's crazy.
With those, and I like seeing that he's basically going to be wearing an ankle brace. He said it's a career-long thing now. He's going to be wearing that. And he needs to do everything that he can to take care of his legs because that's pretty much all of his game.
And on the turf, too. I mean, that was one of the biggest concerns I had when the deal was announced. I was like, oh, man, that hamstring coming to play 80 games a year on that turf.
And seeing Adrian Beltre DH all weekends because Texas wants to keep him off the turf.
Yeah. And what Melky has just, I mean, all year long, I mean, it seems like from the beginning of the season until now, he's been just playing through sore hammies. And he's just waddling out there half the time.
Don't worry. As we'll get into with Jason Wojciechowski, he'll have 100 games to rest those. Kidding. But the other question that I have is that when he comes back, I'm interested to see, I assume they'll put him back at shortstop because he's the franchise guy. You're going to want to keep him in his comfort zone. But I think I might rather see him play third base, at least until Laurie gets back, and leave Kawasaki at shortstop especially against right-handed pitching, because right now the options are essentially DeRosa or LaRoche playing third base. And I think I'd rather see Kawasaki's defense at short, because despite what you might be told by the Mike Wilners of the world, Jose Reyes is not a great defensive shortstop. He was quite good, but he's fallen off with the injuries.
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't have the greatest range factor out there, that's for sure. Yeah, I mean, that's actually a really interesting idea because, you know, you can just imagine the fan base if Kawasaki is the odd man out. And now, obviously, Anthopoulos shouldn't have to worry about that kind of thing, but...
Someone's going to get hurt. Don't worry.
Yeah. Don't say it. But, I mean, Asturias and Boneface are finally starting to play. And Kawasaki, I mean, you know, as great... Like, listen, like, the on-base is great, but, I mean, you know, his weighted is below 300. It's at, like, 280. His weighted runs created is at, like, 73. I mean, if he's not walking, he's not doing anything. So, yeah, that's tough. And I don't want to see DeRosa playing full-time, and I don't want to see any more of LaRoche than I have to. That's a really interesting idea. You know, do you shift over Reyes, you know, just kind of protect him from the shortstop play? Because, you know, putting him at third base obviously protects the legs, protects the ankles for a while.
And I think he can handle it. He's got the arm for it. And
he does, yeah.
So,
as awkward as it looks, it's still a good arm.
He's got
an awkward throwing motion.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen, but, you know, it's worth a shot.
I doubt it, too, but it is actually a very interesting idea.
So, from there, we go to more very positive injury news, and that is Dustin McGowan's miraculous comeback to the major leagues. Quickly, I'm going to run through Dustin McGowan's injury history because it's kind of comical. In 2004, he underwent Tommy John surgery on his elbow, obviously. In 2008, he had a frayed labrum in his shoulder, which can be enough to end a career right there. On his way back from that frayed labrum, he tore his meniscus in his knee. After doing that, he suffered a torn rotator cuff, which was partially torn during the frayed labrum. Why they didn't fix it then, I'm not sure. Then he had debridement in his shoulder, the same shoulder yet again. And then later on that year, he had plantar fasciitis in his foot. So he's had three different shoulder surgeries, an elbow surgery.
Uh-oh. Let's just turn that off.
Just had a heart attack, thanks.
Sorry, Chris. knee surgery and foot surgery, which is no good. But he's finally back on the mound. He's thrown, you know, 20 innings major, in the major league level since 2008, which is, you know, anyone who thought he was going to be back on the mound ever at that point, I sure didn't.
I didn't either. I thought the contract was stupid.
Yeah, still
never
do.
I still do, yeah. But you don't come back from these kinds of injuries, and he's still throwing as hard. Like it's unbelievable. He's still throwing the cheese. It's incredible that he's back out there again. And I firmly believe that he will, as long as he can, he will, because the guy is determined to pitch until his arm literally falls off. Because obviously these ridiculous amounts of shoulder and elbow surgeries aren't going to stop him. Then what is? Any team basically saying no, you can't pitch for us is or a complete dead arm, because he's still killing the radar gun.
Yeah, I had questions about the usage of him in his first game back. He was brought into, I think it was a tie game on Saturday.
Yeah, pretty high pressure situation. I thought that was odd as well.
But you know, you got to use him.
Yeah, it was a tough situation for Gibby. It was the same with today. They, for obvious reasons, don't want to use him on multiple days, but with the game yesterday, and you know, there weren't a whole lot of options, so I can understand why Gibby felt like he was forced to use him today. You know, if they don't go 18 yesterday, I don't think he would have been used today. At least I would hope so, because I don't want to see him get used on 2 days in a row either. I'd like to see them baby him a bit like they do with Jansen to actually get use out of him so his arm doesn't break again.
I'm a little tired of the babying with Jansen at this point, frankly. I'd like to see him be used a bit more.
Yeah, I really want to know, like,
if he's broken, put him on the DL.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I said that day where, you know, there's some Twitter battles going back and forth. But the day that he wasn't used and they pissed away that Atlanta game in extras when they brought in a Bush leaguer who can't throw a breaking ball. And, you know, gave up the lead in the whatever inning, I think it was the 10th or 11th. I was upset about that Jansen was out there twiddling his thumbs. And you know what, they caught him warming up. You know, he was doing some shoulder exercises with a weighted ball. I don't know if he was just testing it, but, I mean, if he's got a sore shoulder from warming up every other day and it's kind of like, well, he's available today, or he's not available today, or he wasn't available yesterday because he had sore shoulder, but now he goes out and pitches a clean ninth today. Like, the very next day? It's like, I'm sorry, but that's an issue. And now he had the shoulder problems coming out of camp. Why didn't he start the season on the DL to get that? Like, why, if he wasn't ready? They were very clear about that he wasn't really ready at the beginning of camp, and even at the beginning of the season. They knew that, and yet they're putting him out there. So it's kind of, and so it's just like, is this going to be a season-long babying that will result in another shoulder surgery at the end of the year? You know, it's frustrating.
It's tough to criticize because he's been so good.
Yeah, that's the other part, is they're like, okay, maybe that's why they're doing it.
But it's very frustrating because he's been so good, and they can't get the usage out of him that I would like to see. He's thrown the least amount of innings on the team, not really, because we've had 29 pitchers.
Right, but he's pitched, what, like 12 innings?
Let me check here. Where is he?
And I'm sure we can, off the top of our head, can think of at least three or four game examples where it's like, why isn't Jansen throwing right now? Or, you know, he'd go like a week without throwing sometimes.
That was the frustration with me in that Atlanta game. He'd already gone four games without an appearance. And, yeah, he's thrown 19 innings. Delabar's at 32. You know, Loop's at 33.
I think Cecil's up there as well.
Yeah, Cecil's at 32. Our highest Fangraphs WAR pitcher, Brett Cecil.
Wow.
Blow me over. I can't
predict ball, right?
No. The two players that I was most down on coming into the year were Lind and Jans and Cecil. So
yeah.
Don't listen
to me.
So moving on to the weekly roster moves. And there's more this week because it's Blue Jays. Ramon Ortiz went to the DL, and there's concerning news with him. I think his career is likely over, which, frankly, I thought it was over 5 years ago. I'm stunned he's still playing. Anthony Gost went back down to AAA, and he's still not stealing bases down there. It's very strange. I don't know what's going on. Henry Blanco was designated for assignments, which meant that Chris's favorite player, Josh Foley, was called up, along with Andy LaRoche. Rajay Davis and Josh Johnson are back from the disabled list. Todd Redmond was sent down to AAA. And then Brad Lincoln was sent down to AAA yesterday after yeoman's work in that 17-inning game. Real shame to see him sent down because he was very good in that game, but he needed to get a fresh arm back here. And that fresh arm was Thaddeus Weber's dramatic return to the team. So I get to say Thaddeus again, which is...
But was he not sent back today after the game, Weber?
Oh, was he?
I could be thinking of somebody else. Don't quote me on that one. But I know somebody was optioned to make room for Oliver tomorrow.
Let's just check up on that. Yep, you're correct. Thad Weber had the brief one-day stay in the major leagues. He made, like, whatever. He gets his per diem. I'm happy about that.
Yeah, he'll get called up again, like, next week or something, I'm sure.
Yep. Actually, I'm not sure about that, because I think the reason they called up Weber is because Redmond and Story couldn't be called back up because they'd been optioned down so recently. So they've got some crappy options they can call up. There's lots of them.
That's not encouraging.
No, it's not. No, it's not. Evan Crawford, in order to get... I want to say it was LaRoche onto the 40-man roster. Evan Crawford was finally designated for assignments, despite having a ERA over 5 in two seasons at AA at the age of 24. I have no clue why he stuck around on the 40-man for this long. He's a bad left-handed reliever, and we have lots of pretty good left-handed relievers, so he's finally gone. And the final move, which won't actually happen until Tuesday, although I guess we're calling up Oliver as well, so there's another one.
Yeah.
But Chin-Ming Wong has been signed off the Yankees. He opted out of his contract with the Yankees, and he will be up to make the start on Tuesday, which we'll get to in our weekly preview. And why don't we hold off on talk about that until the weekly preview?
All right.
So now, let's go to our Jason Wojciechowski interview, which I don't think we mentioned in there. He is a labor lawyer, so he's going to go through the legal ramifications of the Biogenesis scandal involving performance-enhancing drugs, and specifically its involvement with Melky Cabrera. Welcome back to the Blue Jays Plus podcast. Right now we are joined by Jason Wojciechowski of Baseball Prospectus. How's it going, Jason?
It's going all right. How are you guys?
Excellent. One of the upsides of having a prospect named Wojciechowski is I don't need to look up how to spell your last name.
That's impressive. It took me a long time.
Yes, having an eight-letter total name is a benefit that I have enjoyed. So, we brought you on to sort of talk about some of the legalese in this Biogenesis scandal that's going on. The main thing, or to start off with, I'm wondering if it seems like the reports of just receiving shipments of PEDs is enough to warrant a suspension, at least in your opinion.
Yeah, I mean, well, let me say this. The joint drug agreement makes it a violation. It is a violation of the joint drug agreement to possess drugs. You don't have to use them. You can just hold on to them. Whether a shipment sent to you rises to the level of proof of possession, that's harder to say. And that would be, if that were all that baseball had, and this gets to, you know, suspensions and appeals and arbitrations, that could be an issue. But I don't know what kind of proof they have. I can't really fully answer that. I mean, if I were an arbitrator and baseball came to me and said, look, we have a shipping receipt, and it goes from Tony Bosch to—is it Tony? Did I get his name right? To Melky Cabrera, and it's to Melky Cabrera's address in Miami, his off-season home or whatever. But we want to suspend him. I'm honestly not sure what I would do with that. I suspect I would want more.
Okay. Yeah. So you don't actually need to test positive for anything to have a suspension?
That's correct. You can possess, you can distribute. If you're selling drugs or if you're handing out drugs in the locker room, you know, the sort of Jose Canseco model where he's not just using but he's also giving them to everybody in the locker room, then that is also, those are also violations of the joint drug agreement.
Something we might run into with Chris Perez of the Indians this week, depending on what happens with that. So the next major question is what the timetable on these will be, because we're in June right now. How long are we looking at for appeals, or is this going to happen this year? Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it is in MLB's hands, how long it takes them to do their investigation, and they don't. As far as I know, there isn't any sort of statute of limitations kind of situation where, you know, they have to bring a case or they have to bring the suspension within some number of days of finding out about the thing. I think they can just investigate as long as they want to investigate. Once they send notice of the suspension, then things actually move along pretty rapidly. And all of that, all the notice of suspension, as we kind of found out with Ryan Braun, happens or is supposed to happen behind closed doors. That way we never hear about anything if the suspension is never upheld. But in any case, so a notice of suspension will go out. The player has 3 days to file a grievance. Within 20 days of that notice of grievance, the arbitration is supposed to commence. Within 25 days of the commencement of the arbitration, not the end of the arbitration decision is supposed to be given. So, you know, you're looking at 48 days at the outside from announcement or to the player and the union of a suspension. So that is both very quick in the world that I work in. That I mean, I deal sometimes with discipline that was handed down in 2010, and you get around to an arbitration in 2013, which is not ideal. But so this moves it along pretty fast. And on the other hand, if you do get to, you know, that outside end of the time limit, you could be looking, even if a suspension was noticed, you know, yesterday, you could be looking at the end of July before it even starts. 50 games from there, you know, you're kind of in Melky's situation last year where it might carry over into the playoffs.
And hypothetically, because this is supposed to take place behind closed doors, this could have already happened as far as we know, even though it doesn't appear like it has.
Yeah, the notices of suspension could have gone out. Grievance filings could have gone out. They could be on the road to scheduling arbitrations, having arbitrations, because all of this is supposed to be confidential until – well, it's supposed to be confidential, period, if the if the suspension is thrown out. You're only supposed to hear anything if the player gets actually suspended. And it's possible that those confidentiality provisions have been adhered to. It is certainly possible that players have won appeals in the past and we never heard. It seems a little unlikely given the leaks that come out of every front office and Major League Baseball and the union and all the various interests there are in leaking things and what we saw with Braun. But it is at least theoretically notices could have gone out, certainly.
In regards to Melky Cabrera specifically, given that he was suspended last year, seemingly for drugs acquired from Biogenesis, will he be or could he be handled any differently? Obviously, hypothetically, in your opinion, yada yada yada.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't really ding a guy for holding drugs and then using them, like that's not. I mean, there's nothing in the contracts explicitly saying that. There is some sort of language about duplication, but it kind of deals with if you tested positive twice but you hadn't gotten notice of the first positive test, that doesn't count as two separate positive tests. But that's a different situation from here, but I think it's analogous enough that if Melky says, look, these drugs that you've got me receiving are the drugs that you caught me using last year. That's, you know, look at the timeline. On the other hand, I don't know. It's a question of how dumb we think Melky is, I guess. I mean, did he get suspended and then keep getting drugs from Biogenesis? That would be a little silly. But, yeah, I mean, if he has a shipment that happens after, if there's dates on any documents or if Tony Bosch wants to testify about sending Melky drugs, anytime after his prior suspension was probably upheld, assuming he appealed it, which I don't know if he did, then I think this sort of double, you know, I don't know, double jeopardy almost or repeat punishment is not going to come into play. On the other hand, if we're talking about shipments that went to him in, you know, May of last year, then I think he's going to have a very good argument that it was the same drugs and you can't punish him again.
Okay, there's also been some talk that they will be double dipping on certain players. So, for instance, Ryan Braun specifically, I think they're talking about giving him the 50-game suspension for using the first time and also dinging him for lying about it. Is that – what's the status of that?
The lying thing is weird, and I wish people had more sources in baseball who could clarify. You know, I wish I could call up baseball, you know, the labor relations department, and say, you know, give me the legal theory that you're working with here, because I don't really see it. I can theorize about kind of, you know, the JDA says, the Joint Drug Agreement says that you can't facilitate the facilitate the use or facilitate the distribution of drugs. If lying impeded the investigation, thereby allowing Biogenesis to stay alive longer, thereby allowing more drugs to be shipped to baseball players, did it impede, therefore, did it sort of, help the distribution of those drugs? I guess, but if I'm an arbitrator, I don't quite buy that. I think facilitation, you need a little more than that. You need actual, like, you know, providing help to players making contact. Like, if Melky went to Jose Bautista and said, here's my guy's phone number, then that's facilitating distribution. But lying to investigators, I don't think that's facilitating distribution. There is kind of there is power under the collective bargaining agreement to suspend a guy for essentially conduct detrimental to the game.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't necessarily – that's a separate scheme from the joint drug agreement. That's a whole separate suspension. It's not necessarily 50 or 100 games. It's not a sort of second offense under the joint drug agreement. That would just be you lied to us. That's bad for baseball. Therefore, we're suspending you. They could go that route, but – then they would be – there's a whole set of issues with regard to that. They would probably have to prove that lying to them is actually detrimental to baseball. They would have to prove that 50 games or whatever they got was an appropriate suspension, whereas with the drug agreement, the nice thing for baseball is that 50 games is the suspension in the agreement. There's no more, there's no less. That's what the suspension is. The arbitrator has no power to reduce it or to say that's not appropriate. They just find whether the guy violated the agreement or not by using drugs or holding drugs. If they want to go under this detrimental to baseball power, then they're going to have to prove that it was an appropriate suspension, which I think is would be hard.
And I don't think baseball would want to drag this out in order to do that because they're going to have – as many issues already with this, I don't know.
Yeah, and I think that that also changes the timelines. The timelines of those suspensions, the timelines of typical discipline are different from the timelines of the drug agreement discipline.
Okay. Yeah, because if Melky were to be hit with a double-dip suspension on this, his career would be over. And I think someone else in there, but dealing in wild hypotheticals at this point in terms of that. That's all I have in terms of biogenesis. Chris, do you have anything?
Yeah, follow up on what you first mentioned. I didn't realize that you could actually be suspended without a positive test. Now, is the distribution or like the Jose Canseco example, like passing it around the locker room or whatnot, is that new to like the latest CBA or has that been around for a while?
I'm not sure. I never really studied the drug agreements before this because I hate the sort of war on drugs. I don't care what players use personally.
Amen.
So even though this is kind of like legally sort of my area in a way, I've made a point of not really caring. So I don't know. I don't know whether this has always been in the drug agreement, whether this is new. I would also note that actual distribution, I think different from facilitating, but if they were to get Melky handing drugs to Jose Bautista and they got him on actual distribution, the penalties for that are actually higher. Rather than 50, I think they can do anywhere from 80 to 100 on a first offense, and then on a second offense, they're out. So it's not the three offenses and you're out. On the other hand, a distribution offense is different from a use or possession offense, I think. So Melky's use suspension would not count as a first offense, and then this distribution as a second offense. I think it is, you know, use offenses 1, 2, 3, and then distribution offenses 1, 2. I think they're kind of in separate categories. But that's just throwing that out there. I haven't seen any reporting that baseball is going to go after any players for actual distribution of these drugs. I would hope that the players would be careful enough not to get caught doing that. I'm sure it happens. I mean, things get passed around locker rooms and stuff, I'm sure, but I would hope they would be careful enough not to get caught doing that, because I think that would require even more stupidity than getting caught at a clinic.
Yeah, especially nowadays after everything that has happened. You know, I'm sure it's not like the 80s with, you know, Canseco and the Bash Brothers flexing the biceps and passing around steroids in the locker room.
Right, injecting each other in the shower stalls or whatever.
Yeah.
Presumably there'd be criminal charges as well if they actually had someone doing that as well. Because that's not just against baseball rules. That would be illegal as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it certainly would be. I mean, it's illegal to possess these things as well, but the DEA, you know, has certain priorities, and local law enforcement has certain priorities. If I remember right, the ESPN story said that baseball brought Biogenesis to the DEA's authority and tried to sort of flex some political muscle and get the DEA to go after Biogenesis, and the DEA said, this guy's not big enough. We don't care about this guy, or for whatever other reason. I mean, I'm hoping that was the reason and there's not other reasons, but basically declined to go after the guy because they have other enforcement priorities, particularly in Miami.
Anything else, Chris?
No, that was it.
Yeah, one last thing I'd like to touch on is how important is Tony Bosch's credibility here? That seems to be the entire crux of the argument. If you don't find him credible, depending on how much other evidence they were to have, does it all come down to him?
Yeah, realistically, I think the sort of Gomez, Quinn, and Fish story, and also Maury Brown's story at BP, both touched on this, and I agree with them that his credibility is the key point when it comes down to an appeal in front of an arbitrator, because there's documents, but somebody has to authenticate those documents. You can't just put documents out there and say, look, here's these documents. The arbitrator's going to say, what are these documents? Somebody's got to tell me what these documents are, and that's going to be Tony Bosch. So if Tony Bosch gets up there and he's put together and he admits, for instance, that he sold drugs to people, which he hasn't done in public yet. Pedro Gomez, I think, talked to him, and he said, no, I've never sold drugs to anybody. All of that stuff, but if he is credible and he is able to back up any, you know, shipping documents, checks that he received, anything like that, with sort of personal knowledge, yes, Melky Cabrera called me, or I met Melky Cabrera in person. He gave me his cell phone number. He gave me his address. Whatever he's able to say, those are going to be the things that the proof in the case is built on, because I really doubt that outside of Tony Bosch or maybe other people associated with the clinic, anybody's going to come forward and say, I saw Melky holding drugs. I would really hope, you know, as a union side labor lawyer, that solidarity would hold in the baseball clubhouse, and that players, fellow players, are not going to come forward and say, I saw Melky using. I would hope Melky was smart enough not to use in the clubhouse. It really is going to come down to Bosch. If he's up there equivocating and contradicting himself and just kind of behaving like the felon that he is, the arbitrator may have a hard time believing him, may have a hard time believing that he's being entirely truthful, particularly since MLB gave him stuff to testify, not necessarily money, but we will drop our civil lawsuit against you. You know, the union's representatives or attorneys in any arbitration are going to bring that up. They're going to say, what did you get? What has MLB given you in return for your testimony here, in return for your cooperation with their investigation? So all of that's going to be on the table. And, you know, just because he got stuff doesn't mean he's lying, but the arbitrator is definitely going to take it into account in deciding whether to believe him.
Okay, that's really, really good stuff, Jason. Really clears up a lot of misconceptions I've had about this situation. On to your beloved Angels, or Athletics, not Angels, God.
Man, that was almost enough to make me hang up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jesus. They're on fire right now, and they are a mere half game back of the Rangers, who sadly beat us on Sunday. Sorry about that. But for a team that is doing so well, they don't seem to have as clear-cut an all-star selection as one would expect. Looking at their candidates, there doesn't seem to be a pitcher who is really worthwhile. And on the hitting side, their best performer this year has been Josh Donaldson, kind of out of nowhere. Who would you expect, or more than one, would you expect to make the All-Star team if they were to be picked at the moment?
I think, well, yeah, Donaldson has been their best player. Unfortunately, the American League third base has a certain fat MVP, standing over there. Nice. So that's a tough position to crack, along with Longoria and even Beltre. Actually not sure how Beltre is playing, but he's somewhat famous. Coco Crisp has also played well, but the outfield is hard. I think given the lack of famous guys on the A's, I'm a little concerned that their representative is going to be Grant Balfour. When you get the manager of the All-Star team picking the one representative to fill in, and they often look to the bullpen. And Balfour has a 1.37 ERA. He's got 15 saves already. That could be 20 or so by the time we get around to picking the teams or more. I'm not even sure when All-Star teams get picked, but. Yeah, if he keeps pitching that well, I would not be surprised if, he comes out pitching in the fifth inning of the All-Star game as the A's representative. And despite how Donaldson has played, he's kind of, he becomes the guy that everybody talks about as like the big snub on the A's. I would like it to be Cespedes, not necessarily because of how he's played this year. It's kind of all power and no on base percentage, but he's fun. He's the guy I want to see in an exhibition game, just swinging from the back of his heels and, trying to throw somebody out at first base from left field and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I would either like to see Cespedes make the team or Donaldson as the third catcher, because that'd be really fun as well.
That would also be fun. I think the A's might protest putting him behind the plate. They might file an official grievance with the league if they did that.
Okay, I think that's all that we've got for you. Thank you very much, Jason. Throw some plugs out. Where can they find your stuff?
Baseball Prospectus Weekly. I have my A's blog at Beanball, B-E-A-N-E, ball, as in Billy Bean, .org. That's pretty much it these days. But I am at those places. I'm just going to keep repeating myself at those places.
Your podcast doesn't get a plug?
Oh, I guess I have a podcast. So, sorry, Matt Corey, if you're listening to this. The Back of the Bullpen podcast, you can search for that on iTunes or – I don't know how good our Google is. I don't know if you Google Back of the Bullpen whether you get us. But, that is my podcast with Matt Corey, also Baseball Prospectus and various other outlets, kind of a general baseball podcast.
Previous Blue Jays Plus guest, Matt Corey. So, thanks a lot, Jason. We'll be back to wrap up when we're back. Back, and to start off with our music this week, coming into this segment was the theme song to Orphan Black, which I will talk about in just a second, although hypothetically I probably should have mentioned that second, because whatever. The other music this week is Depeche Mode, who is one of the best bands of the 80s, and I love them, and they're great. So listen to Depeche Mode, they're awesome. On to some pop culture, because I can't be bare to talk about the Blue Jays nonstop every week because they're depressing as hell. And my second love after baseball is television. I watch more television than probably anyone you will ever meet. And this week I got really, really into a show on BBC America, which is on space in Canada, called Orphan Black, starring Canadian Tatiana Maslany. It's one of the best performances that I have seen in many, many years. It's probably, or at least it's definitely the best female performance I've seen on TV in at least two or three years. Basically, the show is about clones, which they take a little while to break in, but if you can't figure it out pretty quick, you're not really paying much attention. In the show, she plays essentially seven different characters. And then within that, she multiple times in the show will play one of those characters impersonating another one of the characters. And the amazing thing about her performance is that each of these characters feels completely and totally different. Frequently when you see actors doing this, playing multiple roles, they will be doing very little to differentiate the characters. They'll be letting the wig they're wearing do the work. They'll be letting their weak accents do the work. But in her case, the body language of the characters is wildly different. One of the characters, for instance, is sort of an uptight soccer mom type. And one of them is sort of a grifter from England. And the body language between those two is remarkable because one of them is uptight, and immediately looking at her, you know it's her. And the other one is sort of a punk, and she's slumped down, and everything about her changes. But what really gets me is she will be impersonating one of her personas while in a different persona, which is a mindfuck if you think about it. And you actually see the internal flaws of each character in that performance. It's blowing me away just how good it is. Aside from the rest of the show, which is a very propulsive thriller with excellent, plot twists that you don't see coming, it is a science fiction show that kind of requires you to turn your brain off, but I think they do a good enough job with the plot development that you don't have time to think about what's going on. They just move you along very quickly. Chris, I made you watch the first episode, and I think you rather enjoyed it. What were your thoughts?
I was blown away. Now, I only caught three performances that she had to put on, and it was incredible. Everything you just described, there was no wig or clothing that made the difference. She literally became a different person. And especially when they're on camera at the same time, I mean, that really blew me away. Yeah, a 45-minute pilot episode, I usually don't get that excited about a pilot, but I'm going to catch up very quickly by the end of this week because I was hooked. I was hooked 3 minutes in.
Yeah.
That's incredible. I don't think I've ever been hooked that quickly on a TV show before.
No, they grab you right from the start. And you were talking about I've been completely obsessed with this girl. She's from Regina. I listened to a whole bunch of interviews with her this week, or sorry, last night, and talking about the process that they go through. She's essentially doing 18-hour shoots per day. There was one day in their entire shoot segment that she was not on camera, and that's because she got sick. She will essentially do one scene acting against nobody, just memorizing where her eyes have to go, etc. She will then leave set, do an hour and a half of makeup change, hair change, everything, walk back on the set, now have to know what she previously did in that scene, and do it again. There are times in the show where four of her are on screen at once. So that means she is recording that scene four different times in a row. It's unbelievable. And I think one of the things that's so effective about her is that she's essentially a complete unknown.
Yes, I had never heard of her. I found her on Twitter after you told me about it.
So did I.
And I looked her up. I IMDb'd her, and I'm like, yep, no idea who this person is. So I went in totally blind. I didn't really read anything about it except just a little quick synopsis, like a sentence synopsis, basically, which really doesn't tell you anything about the show.
No.
Like I said, I was hooked after 3 minutes, like literally the opening. That's how good it was.
I just like seeing someone who gets this involved in the process. She says that she has different music lists that she listens to as she's in her hair and makeup for each different character, and those put her in the mindset of the character. It's just it blew me away. I haven't been this obsessed about a show in I can't even remember how long, and now I have to wait almost a year for it to come back, and I'm disappointed. What,
2 seasons so far, correct?
1 season.
Oh, okay.
And first, yeah, you're not very far behind. 10 episodes.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah. From there, we're going to go to the week ahead. And the Blue Jays, after a fairly successful series against the Rangers, taking 2 of 3, they head into Chicago to take on the Sad Sack White Sox, who are a complete mess right now. And I think we're not too far away from Robin Ventura getting fired or stepping away because he refused a contract extension in the offseason, saying he wanted to prove himself, which I have a lot of respect for.
But...
but, yeah, he's going to get fired. He handles the bullpen very well, but the team sucks, and there's no help coming. But
your series coming up, like when you're going in and you need critical wins, yeah, pretty big series when you're facing the Sad. What did you say, Sad Sox? No, White Sox?
Yeah, exactly, the Sad Sox. So Monday we get R.A. Dickey trying to extend his successful run against National League teams back in the American League against Jill and Axelrod, frankly, the kind of pitcher that we should dominate. Then we get to Chin-Ming Wong making his Blue Jays debut as the 30th pitcher on the year, making the Blue Jays have the 18th most pitchers used in Major League Baseball history. It's the second week of June. Yeah.
What do you even say to that?
Nothing. Really interesting. I was looking up those facts, and the Blue Jays last year had the second most pitchers used in Major League history, and the year before that, they had, I think, the 12th most used. So it's something Alex Anthopoulos likes to do. The key with Wong on the mound is we need to put our best defense on the field.
Yes.
He has one of the lowest strikeout rates in Major League history. So I would expect to see Asturias at third base, Bonifacio at second base, potentially. Just, he's a ground ball machine if he's on, and I hope he's on, because I really like him. He's a Steve McEwen special, just a ground baller.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we're not going to get the, the 2004 version of him, but if he can show any kind of positive outlook like he has in the minors for the past year, you know, it would be a nice little pickup, for at least a short-term pickup.
Yep. He's just got to, plug the hole, because if Morrow, I don't think Morrow's out too long, so that's basically what we're waiting on with him. Although this next guy who's up, the mismatch of the week, is Esmel Rogers making an improbable third start, and he's been very good, but
yeah,
given the state of the bullpen, he's not going to go long. So,
yeah, Dickey is going to have to pitch another gem. Give the bullpen a nice little break, and hopefully Wong isn't, hopefully he gives us more than 5 innings.
I think Wong will be out there quite a while, regardless of how effective he is, because you're going to need the bullpen for Rogers. And he's taking on Chris Sale, who is fantastic and is going to break, but hasn't yet. So that's a mismatch there. We then head into another series with the Rangers, which has the same first two matchups that we saw this weekend, with Mark Burley against Yu Darvish, who is really fun to watch. The guy's just awesome. Makes me really sad that we didn't get him.
Yeah, it's like a little extra little dagger. Seeing him pitch twice in a week against the Blue Jays. It's just like salt in the wound.
And then the matchup from Sunday, which was Josh Johnson against Justin Grimm, which should potentially be in the Blue Jays' favor. And then finally, the probable starter for the Rangers is recent minor league call-up Josh Lindblom, but I could see that changing because Alexei Ogando had to go onto the disabled list against R.A. Dickey making his second start of the week. So that's a positive. Looks like it's a week that we should do fairly well in, and we need to. June's got to be our month.
Yeah. Offense needs to light it up as well. Score, I believe, was it 8 runs in the past 60 innings?
Something like that.
Yeah. something really bad, and we're just, you know, lucky that we've gotten some really good starts out of, you know, Dickey, Johnson, Rogers, Burley. So offense needs to wake up.
Absolutely. And on the housekeeping, you can follow me at Mentoch, M-E-N-T-O-C-H. You can follow Blue Jays Plus at Blue Jays Plus. And Chris, go ahead.
And you can follow me at Sherlander6.
So that's all we have for you this week. Yeah, talk to you next week. Go Jays, go.